One thing I did want to ask, I think I mentioned it last week, but I just, for some reason, my mistake, I mentioned it after I had, before I had started the recording. And that is that if anybody is on this group who's not on my email list, if they're not getting my email reminders for the shiur, then I just put your name and email in the chat. Now, after the recording is started, so I'll have a recording of the chat too. And I'll make sure you get added to the email list. So if you did it last week, thank you. But when the time the shiur ended, it got deleted because I didn't record the chat. So I apologize for that. All right. So let's start. I'm gonna put everybody on a temporary mute. And feel free to chime in, as they say. Yeah. All right. Last week we spent time looking at the question of the dynamic of the relationship between David and Bathsheba that first night that they spend together, and whether or not David was guilty of adultery in that moment. From a legal perspective, I want to reiterate that no kind of justification, if you will, of the context here exonerates David from the moral offense. The only question is whether or not there was a technical legal offense of adultery as well. And whereas on the one hand, the text seems to emphasize that she was Eshet Uriah Chiti, that she was married. She was Mrs. Uriah Chiti, right? Halazot Bat Sheva Bat Eliam Eshet Uriah Chiti. Uriah later on refers to her as Ishti. Nonetheless, there are hints to the fact that there's a more complex relationship. Things aren't exactly as they would seem, and evidence the fact that she may not be in the legal sense Eshet Ish. The most glaring piece of it being the nevuah of Natan, when Natan comes to criticize David in Perek Yudbet, he makes no reference to the chait of that initial night together. His issue is the stealing of Bathsheba from, sort of the gazela involved, the stealing of Eshet Uriah, as well as the execution of the murder or orchestrating the death of Uriah Chiti, and then ultimately the moral offense of marrying Bathsheba. So all of that is in the nevuah of Natan, but what's not in the nevuah of Natan is any reference to the isur of Eshet Ish, of adultery. That added to the fact that the Navi allows David to remain married to Bathsheba, and in fact, the child of that union is the heir to the throne in Shlomo, it's complicated to suggest that their relationship that first night was in fact a legal context of adultery. And so that led us back to Shmuel ben Achmeni's position that the story is not quite as it seems. The relationship is more complex, and that maybe Shmuel ben Achmeni's suggestion, which was that there was some kind of get written for a soldier before he went out to battle, and that get enabled or protected the wife in the case of the death of the husband, in case of Aguna, so protected from either the status of Aguna or Yibum, and to some extent David takes advantage of that legal loophole and enters into the complex story of his relationship with Bathsheba. That is one option. And we suggested at the end of the shiur that as compelling as it sounds to sort of address the legal issue related to Eshet Ish, it raises other questions. Number one, it's unclear how such a get operates, even from a halachic perspective. Even if you operate within the context of the Gemara's discussion of Shmuel ben Achmeni, unclear at all how such a get operates, whether it operates immediately or it's conditional upon the death of Uriah. If it's conditional upon the death of the husband, then David, by inviting Uriah back from the battlefield, is actually complicating the story, not helping. And ultimately, the biggest question of all is that such a get has no reference whatsoever in the text. It's just, there's no reference to it. And that might be intentional, right? The text might be telling me, right, maybe David thinks he has an out because there's a get, but I'm telling you from a moral perspective, we're going to hold David accountable for adultery. That's essentially the message of the story. At the end of the day, the whole point of Natan's nevuah to David is that you may have thought that because of all these legal loopholes, you were able to justify your actions, but I'm holding you accountable morally and ethically for everything that you've done. That's really the gist of the story. And we had suggested in an earlier shir that that's more or less what Shmuel Nachmeni is looking at in all of these cases, where the text holds the people accountable for a moral offense, even though they in their minds may think that they have committed a lesser offense. And that's really the theme that connects all six of the cases that Shmuel Ben Nachmeni mentions. Nonetheless, there's a certain discomfort with this idea of a get, because there's no reference to it in Tanakh anywhere, and it's kind of seems a little bit stretched. So what I wanted to suggest today is a different approach to the same question, meaning I'm still looking for a way of navigating through the mindset of how David thought that there was no issue of adultery in this context, and thereby took all the steps that he did, even though the Navi will hold him completely accountable for it. And I think it was mentioned in either this year or in the Wednesday night year, I don't remember, a kind of a potential approach. And I want to throw that on the table at this time. And that's to look at not Bathsheba and David, but to go back and look at Uriah and ask the question, what do we know about Uriah? So the story of Uriah is interesting because he's really only mentioned here. This is the first time we encounter him. Vayishlach David al Yoav, Vayishlach David vayidvosh liisha vayomer halozot Bathsheba bat Eliam eshet Uriah achiti. This Bathsheba is Bathsheba bat Eliam, the wife of Uriah achiti. Eliam, I mentioned last week, is is Ben Achitophel. David has an advisor, Yoetz, very close to him. Chazal says he's David's Rebbe. There's a whole discussion about Achitophel in the Medrash, but Achitophel is a very important persona. We'll see later in the story, and Eliam is the son of Achitophel. So Bathsheba is the granddaughter of David's advisor Achitophel. That's a piece of information which you just have to pull the pieces together from Divrei Hayamim to hear to see that Eliam is Eliam ben Achitophel. And suddenly Bathsheba is a much more familiar personality persona to the story than just a stranger who David happens to see from a distance. Nonetheless, the question that I want to raise is, who is Uriah Hachiti? Who is he? What do we know about him? Where does he come from? What can we learn from this? So the truth is that we don't know anything about him in the story of Sefer Shmuel Aleph or up until this point in Shmuel Bet. But as I've said many times, Tanakh is a big circle, and you kind of have to look at the totality of the picture of Tanakh to see all the pieces come together. Uriah Hachiti does appear in another place in Tanakh. In particular, he appears in the list of David's band of soldiers who are with him from the very beginning. So I want to take us to, we were in Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Aleph, I want to take us to Shmuel Bet Perek Chaf Gimel. I'm actually going to jump to a source page in a second, so I will do what I did last week, which is for the benefit of those who need it. I will put the source page in the chat. All right. You want to download it, you'll have it. Otherwise, I'll display it on the screen momentarily. All right, it's over here. Okay, so let's talk about this parak Chav Gimel. It's at the end of the Sefer, sort of the last couple of prakim of the Sefer. I've mentioned in the past that the last few chapters of Shmuel Bet are a kind of appendix. They're a collection of stories or episodes or events or lists that are much earlier in chronological context. We'll look at them separately and we'll study them separately, but nonetheless, Ela Divrei David Achronim, kind of a message of David, a Shira of David. I'm going to skip the first part. Then we get to Perachav Gimel Pasuk Chet. This is the end of Shmuel Bet, Perachav Gimel Pasuk Chet. Ela Shmot HaGiborim Asher LeDavid. The list of the Giborim that David had in his arsenal. These Giborim, if you remember from the early days that David ran from Shaul, he had gathered around him a group of 400 men. Later they became 600. They were referred to as the Tzva HaGiborim, the army of the Giborim. When Yoav goes to fight against Ammon, and he gets caught because Ammon brings Aram into the picture that we studied at the beginning of, at the end of last year. Yoav splits the army into the Giborim and the rest of the army of Israel. These Tzvah Giborim is a kind of a special forces in David's army. They were a group that was together from early stories. And these stories that are listed here, besides listing the names of them, are also events that had taken place early in David's time with them as the head of this group. So this is the list. Shmot HaGiborim Shel David. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole list. I want to look at the style of how this list is written. That's really my goal, is to understand how this list is written. I can already tell you, and at the very end of the parak, if you look down at the bottom, the last one listed in Pasuk Lametet is Uriah HaChiti. So Uriah HaChiti appears here in this list, the very last name. The list appears twice in Tanakh, once here and once in Divrei Hayamim. In Divrei Hayamim, Uriah HaChiti is listed here, but he's not the last name. There's a couple of names after him. In Shmuel Bet, the list stops at Uriah HaChiti. That's probably not an accident. It's probably a way of kind of another kind of shtuch, if you will, another jibe at David. Once you got to Uriah HaChiti, there's not much more to say. But nonetheless, this is the list. I want to go back to this list and I want to look at how it is written. And you'll see what I mean by that in a moment. Elish Motak Yibur Meshel David, Yoshev Bashevet. It's the name of the person, Yosheva Shevet, Tach Kimoni. What is Tach Kimoni? So again, there is a name, and then there is this description, Yosheva Shevet, Tach Kimoni. He was the head of a triad, a shlishi. There's the entire structure of the army of these Giborim was grouped into three. There was a special units made up of three soldiers, and there was a rosh to each three, a captain to that group. And who Adoni Etzni, another name Adoni, or Adino Haetzni, who had smitten 800 chalalim. These are various stories that make up a kind of a list of heroic acts. Elazar ben Dodo ben Achochi, another little story. Shama ben Age Harari, Shama son of Age Harari. Again, what does Harari mean? Translates here as the Ararite. Yasu Plishtim. After that, you have, I'm going to skip a little bit. Let's go down to Avishai, Achi Yoav ben Suya. Okay, those are names that we are familiar with from Shmuel, from the end of Shmuel Aleph, Avishai. Yoav ben Suya, Benayahu ben Yoyada, another name that we have encountered, Rav Pa'alim Mikavtzael. He was a valiant man from Kavtzael, and he smote the lions, etc. Okay, that's good. Now we get to, here's the kind of the stories diminish, and now we just get to the lists. Asael is the third brother of Avishai, Yoav, and Asael, Achi Yoav. Elchanan ben Dodo Bet Lachem. Elchanan ben Dodo Bet Lachem. I want to stop here for a second. Every time one of these names is mentioned, we've had this additional word that appears after their name. Yosheb Shevet Tach Kemoni. What is that additional word? Harari, Tach Kemoni. Shema Hachordi, Elika Hachoradi. Right? What does this Choradi mean? So the easiest way to see it is here's one that's familiar to us. Elchanan ben Dodo Bet Lachem, or if I were to put it in terminology, into structure of similar kind of phrases elsewhere, Elchanan ben Dodo Bet Halachmi, meaning Elchanan ben Dodo, who comes from
Bet Lachem.
So the list identifies the name of the person, his father, and the location or city from which they come. Keep that in mind, because that structure is very important for us. Shama HaChoradi, Elika HaChoradi, two individuals, Shama and Elika from Chorid or Chorad. Cheletz HaPalti, again from a place. Ira ben Ikesh HaTko'i, there's a place that at least we're familiar with, right? Tekoa. So Ira ben Ikesh from Tekoa. Aviezer HaAntoti, Aviezer from the city of Anatot. Anatot is a very famous city. We haven't encountered it, actually. We have. It's the hometown of Eli.
What about Yirmiyahu?
And Eliyahu, and the most famous, right? So, and it links to Yirmiyahu in a much later arc, that Yirmiyahu is also from Anatot, Anavi Hashem Anatot. So, correct. That is Aviezer HaAntoti. Mivunai HaChushati. Mivunai from Chush, Salmon HaAchochi, and again, assuming that the structure here is the same for all of these names, the first is the name of the individual, and the second is the name of the city from where they live or where they're identified with. Mari HaNetofoti, Netof, Netofet, Chelev ben Ba'ana HaNetofati, Itai ben Rivai Migivat Beit Binyamin. Again, Itai ben Rivai from Givat Bnei Binyamin. Clearly a reference to a location. Benayahu Piratoni. He comes from a area called Piraton. Actually, one of the Nevi'im. Sorry, one of the Shoftim is also from that same area. Hidai Minachale Gash. Avi Albon Ha'arvati. Az Mavet HaBarchumi, El Yachba HaSha'alboni, that should be another familiar one to us, right? Anybody ever hear of a place called Sha'albim? Okay, Sha'albim, Sha'alvim, today is both the kibbutz and the yeshiva. Sha'alboni is from Sha'alabim. Sha'alabin, as it's referred to in Sefer Yeshua. Bnei Yashen Yonatan, Shama HaHarari, Achiam, which is another, we've encountered Harari earlier, Achiam ben Shira HaHarari, Eli Feled ben Achasbi ben Hama'achati, Eliam ben Achitofel, there's that Eliam ben Achitofel. I mentioned you, Batsheva, but Eliam is Eliam ben Achitofel. So there you have the reference to Eliam ben Achitofel HaGiloni. Chetzrei HaKarmeli comes from the Kamel. Vivian, that one's for you, right? Pa'arai HaArbi. Yigal ben Natan mi Tzova. Tzova, of course, Aram Tzova is Aleppo up in the north. We had Tzova. Bani HaGadi, Bani who comes from Gad. Now life gets complicated. Tzelek ha'amoni. Tzelek, who comes from Amon. Nachrai ha-be'erotti. Nachrai comes from Be'erot. Anybody remember what Be'erot was? We had a conversation about Be'erot last year. Be'erot is a city in the area of Eretz Plishtim to which the Givonim, after Shaul had destroyed the Givonim, had run and had escaped to. So the Be'erotti are most likely descendants or connected to the Givonim. The people who killed Ishbosheth were Be'erotti, if you remember. This Nacharai HaBe'erotti was the armor bearer of Yoav ben Tzruya. Ira HaYitri, Irav Yeter. Garev HaYitri, also. Uriah HaChiti, and Uriah HaChiti. Okay. So, more or less, that's the list. And in and of itself, there wouldn't be anything particularly significant to derive from this list other than the fact that Uriah HaChiti and Bathsheba are both part of David's inner circle. Uriah HaChiti is a warrior, gibor, amongst David's loyal giborim from the very beginning. And Bathsheba is Bat Eliam, who is Eliam ben Achitophel, and Achitophel is, again, one of David's chief advisors. However,
question.
Yeah.
Are we to understand from this list that these 37 soldiers and special to David are not all B'nai Yisrael, they're not all Hebrew or Jewish?
I haven't made any reference to that yet. We're going to come to that question in a second.
Okay.
On the face of it, all I have is a list of names and the places where they come from. And it's not uncommon to have reference to people by the identification of where they come from. Where they come from doesn't necessarily mean where their legal lineage status is. It happens to be where they live, right? If a person lives in Beit Lechem, so he's referred to as Beit Lechmi. If he lives in Ephrat, he's referred to as Ephrati. If he lives in Amon, if he lives in Yeter, if he lives in the Kamel, if he lives in the Eretz Chet, if he lives in Be'erot, if he lives wherever they live, they are identified by the name of the city from which they come. So there are a lot of these names that we would otherwise have identified as maybe as foreigners. On the other hand, it's not at all clear that they are foreigners. It's more likely, or it would seem, that they are just listed as people who live in a particular region based on this list. In other words, the more likely scenario based on this list, if I look at it as a consistent pattern, is that these are all the names of the cities in which these individuals live. It doesn't say anything particularly about their lineage. And that is not uncommon. In Sefer Shmuel in particular, this is a very common form. Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, more so than perhaps anywhere else, you have this kind of reference a lot. And it behooves us to kind of look at that and see, okay, well, what does that tell me about these individuals? What can we derive from them? I'll give you an example of what I'm trying to get at. Let's take a look at this story. Okay, this isn't Shmuel Bet. This one's not on the source page. I'm going to jump to the source page in a minute, but this one is not on the source page. This is a story we studied at the beginning of middle of last year, I think. Shmuel Bet Perek Vav. This is 2 years ago. This is when they were moving the Aron from Kiryat Yarim to Yerushalayim. Remember the story? We read it as a Haftorah, Parashat Shmini. When the Aron was slipping and Uzzah and Perez grabbed it and destroyed. All right, so after the Aron and the tragedy of the Aron, Vayar David et Hashem, Vayirah David et Hashem b'yomahu, v'yomer ech yavoy lai Aron Hashem. I said, I can't bring the Aron to Yerushalayim. V'lo avad David lasir elav et Aron Hashem. He decided that it was too premature, he couldn't do it. Vayateu David bet Oved Edom Oved Edom Hagiti. And so he placed it into the responsibility of Oved Edom Hagiti. Based on the pattern that we've had so far, what can you tell me about Oved Edom Hagiti? Gat, city in Eretz Plishtim, right? Gat is a city of, in the land of the Plishtim. So what would that tell me about Oved Edom Hagiti?
She's from Philistia.
It sounds like he lives in or comes from the area of Eretz Plishtim, especially with the name like Oved Edom. Sounds like, right? There's another famous personality in David's circle or in Shaul's circle who's identified with Edom, namely. We're going to see him in a second. His name is Doeg HaAdomi. Right? Doeg HaAdomi is the soldier who Shaul sends to execute the city of Nov, Yer HaKohanim, for having harbored David. So I have Doeg HaAdomi, I have Oved Edom Hagiti, right? Just on the basis of the name, I might be tempted to say that this Oved Edom is in fact a Plishti, is a Gittite. Gat is a city in the Eretz Plishti. You follow the pattern that I'm trying to identify? That the name of the city, the moment I put them into a foreign city, maybe they are foreigners, maybe they're not even Jewish. Okay, problem. Not so fast.
Yeah, he's taking the Aron through, he wouldn't be taking the Aron through Philistine territory.
Okay, now, v'lo avad David l'asir elav ataron Hashem al ir David v'ater David bet Oved Edom Hagiti. He sends it to the house of Oved Edom Hagiti. So here, very simple, we're going to look at the Mefarshim. Who is Oved Edom Hagiti? Says Rashi, Levi haya. He was a Levi. He was a Levite. K'moshe katub b'divrei Yamim. And if I pull up the pasuk in Divrei Yamim, it says very clearly that these are the lists of the Levim, Emmanuel, etc. And amongst the Mishorim that were there, various roles that the Levim had, was Yimehem Achem Mishnim Zechayah ben V'Yizel Shmiram Mot V'Yichiel, all of the names of the Levim, and amongst them is Oved Edom. These were the Sho'arim, and then you had the Meshoarim, right? The houses of the Levim were set up into various roles, those who were in the choir and those who opened the gates, the Sho'arim and the Meshoarim. And amongst them is Oved Edom. So Rashi correctly points out that this Oved Edom is a Levi, which would explain why, in the context of the story, David, whose most significant chait in this story was placing the Aron on a wagon and not having Kohanim carry the Aron, etc. When he realizes the mistake, the first thing he does is he takes the Aron and he sends it to a Levi for safekeeping. That Levi is Oved Edom. So why is he called Oved Edom Hagiti? Because he happens to live in the city of Gat. In other words, the identification of these individuals with cities that aren't necessarily Israelite cities doesn't mean, and this is very important, doesn't mean that they are not Israelites. It means that they live in a city that isn't necessarily identified historically as always a Jewish city. Gat is part of Eretz Plishtim, but it's quite possible that I have Israelites living there. And certainly Oved Edom comes from Gat. Where he is right now, it's unclear, but he comes from the city of Gat. But in this case, he's clearly a Levi. I want to make that very clear. Right. Now, there are other stories, other individuals in Sefer Shmuel who are similarly identified as connected to a city that isn't necessarily of Jewish city, and therefore begs the question, right? Who are they? What's their status? So, for example, now I'm going to jump to the source page. It'll just make life a little easier for us. These are the ones we've encountered so far. Tzelek Ammoni. Does that mean he's an Ammonite? Or does that mean he comes from an area in Ammon, but he's an Israelite living in Ammon? Similarly, Nachrai HaBe'eroti, who comes from an area that is essentially a city of the Givonim, or Iraha Yitri, Yeter is Mibnei Yeter, Chovev is Yitro, or Yahiti. Are they Israelites who live in areas that are broader than just the core Israel Jewish cities, or are they by origin and lineage from a foreign reference? I have in Divrei HaYamim a reference to Ovil HaYishmaeli, also in David's world. In Shmuel Aleph, we encountered, this one's not on the list in the end of Shmuel Bet, but we encountered an individual by the name of Ayan David Vayomer El Achimelech Achiti Ve'al Avishai Ben Tsruya Achi Yoav Lemor Mi Yerediti O Shaul. Here's a very good example. This is a story also in Shmuel Aleph. When, remember when Shaul is encamped chasing David, and there's one story where David finds him in a cave, and then there's another story where David finds Shaul sleeping amongst his men in the middle of the field. And David has the opportunity to go down and kill Shaul in the middle of the night. So he turns to his soldiers, to his giborim. Abishai ben Tsruya is the brother of Yoav. And he says to two of his chief soldiers, Achimelech Hachiti and Abishai ben Tsruya Achi Yoav. And he says to them, who wants to come with me as we go to Shaul in the middle of the night and do what we have to do? And of course, Avishai thinks that David wants to kill Shaul, so Avishai volunteers. But I come back to the same question. I have Uriah Hachiti, and now I have Achimelech Hachiti. Second person in the story identified as Hachiti. Is Achimelech Hachiti Israelite living in Eretz Chet, which is more or less Turkey today, or is he a foreigner serving in David's army? Same question I have with Selaka Ammoni from Ammon. Again, if I work off the model of Eved Edom Hagiti, and clearly he was a Levi, then most of these people, I would assume, and there's so many of them, I would assume that they, on the face of it, it would seem that they are Israelites who are coming, who are living, who are identified by these various geographic regions. That's the question. That ultimately is the question that we have to deal with. Let's take a look at the next one. Doeg Adomi. Doeg Adomi is a very powerful part of the story because he is the one who executes the city of, he is Shaul's chief warrior, Me'avdei Shaul. He sees David in hiding in Nov. He goes and he tells Shaul. Shaul says, who's going to go and destroy the city of Nov? And Doeg Adomi volunteers. Very dramatic story. Who is Doeg HaAdomi? So Radak says, I'm going to skip 17 for a second. Radak says very clearly, Doeg HaAdomi, gar be'eretz Edom, he lives in the area of Eretz Edom, lefichach kro'o Adomi, that's why he's called Edomi. Similarly, v'chein Uriah HaChiti, or Yitra HaYishmaeli, or Itai HaGiti, all of these people who we've now given you the list, and there's many more of them, miyuchasim al shem mekomam sheyu garim bahem. They are identified by the city in which they live, not as a lineage, but as a locale, a region, meaning they're Israelites. They just live in various places throughout the country. That's the position of the Radak. And the Radak is very consistent. Another place where we find this kind of reference is the story of Itai HaGiti. Now we haven't had this, we haven't encountered the story yet. This story is in Shmuel Bet Perek Tetvav. As David, a series of events that take place in the aftermath of the story of Bathsheba, one is the story of Amnon and Tamar, and that leads to rebellion to Avshalom's rebellion. And in the midst, Avshalom's rebellion is really the kind of the end of Sefer Shmuel. David is forced into exile. David literally goes into exile together with his household and his soldiers. and his forces, and he's leaving Yerushalayim. And as he leaves Yerushalayim, actually, let's look at this in the text, it'll be easier. As he's leaving Yerushalayim, ויאמר דוד לכל עבדיו אשר איתו בירושלים, קומו ונברחה. David says to all of his servants who are with him in Yerushalayim, come, we are leaving. כי לא תהיה לנו פליטה מפני אבשלום. If we stay, we'll be killed. We have no choice here, we have to leave. מרו ללכת, פן ימהר והשיגנו ודיח עלינו הרעה והיכה העיר לפיכר. If we stay, David is kind of processing. The last time David was a refugee and he was harbored in a city, the king killed every member of that city. If you remember the story of Nov. So David says, if I stay in Yerushalayim, he won't just kill me, he'll kill the entire city of Yerushalayim. So David says, we'll leave. We are with you. They leave. All right. They're standing at a place called Bet Merchak. B'chol avadav ovrim al yado. His servants pass with him. Ala kreti v'ala preti. B'chol hagitim shesh miot ish asher bao b'raglo migat. Together with 600 people from Gat. Gat is a city of in Eretz Plishtim. Ovrim opnei ha-melech, they pass by the king. Vayomer ha-melech el Itai ha-giti. The king turns to a gentleman by the name of Itai of Gat, Itai ha-giti, and he says to him, Lama telech gamata itano? Why are you also coming with me? Shuv, you go home, you and all your people. V'shevim ha-melech ki nochri ata. For you are a foreigner. V'gam tzoleata limkomecha. V'goleata limkomecha. Why should you have to exile from your place? You came yesterday. Should I now make you go and travel and exile with us? I have to go where I have to go. You go home. Shuv, hashevet achecheimach. Take your brothers with you. Chesed be'emet, and kindness. Itai answered the king and he said, Chai Hashem, Chai Adoni HaMelech, ki b'makom ha-she-yesham Adoni HaMelech, im l'mavet, im l'chaim, ki sham ye'avadecha, we will go with you as the king lives, surely as God lives, wherever you go, we will go, wherever you die, we will die. Sounds like Ruth, right? Vayomer David al Itai, lech va'avor. David says to Itai, go, just go home. So Itai Giti passes by together with all of his men and all of the children who were with him. And that's the story of Itai HaGiti and the 600 Gitim, Anshei Gat, who try to go into exile with David, and David tells them to go home, Ki Nochri Ata, because you are foreigners. Now the name Itai HaGiti follows exactly the same pattern that we've had from the beginning. So here, the Radak says, I don't want to show you this Radak. Okay, the Radak is actually, okay. I need to show you this Gemara before I do the Radak. This Gemara deals with a different question altogether. We'll see at the end of the story of Shmuel that there's a moment where David is in the final conquest of Ammon. David takes a crown off the heads of the soldiers who he killed. Bekachet ateret malkam, he takes this crown off the king. And very heavy crown, and he places it on his own head. To which the Gemara asks the question, Umishari, how is it permissible to take the crown off of these Ammonites? Yisrei Hananinu, they are idolatrous, and you're not allowed to derive any benefit from any idolatrous object. Amar Rav Nachman, Itai Hagiti Ba Ubitla. In David's inner circle was a Gentile by the name of Itai Hagiti, and this Gentile came and he had the ability, a Gentile can take an object that belongs to Avodah Zarah and nullify its Avodah Zarah status by rendering it or directing it to something else. In other words, to go from idolatry to Israelite use is prohibited, but if a non-Jew comes and he uses it for some secular purpose, it kind of nullifies its idolatrous status, and that gives David the ability to use it. So the Gemara here is assuming that a Itai Hagiti is a Gentile. I want to make that, that's essentially where the story begins. Which the Radak says, why do they need to say that Itai Giti is a Gentile? If it's because he's called Giti, what? Here's somebody else who comes from Gat. Oved Edom Hagiti. And he was certainly a Levi. He wasn't a Gentile. The Karo Giti. The fish he go to Gat, and he's called Giti because he lives in Gat. V'chein Itai Yisrael, Itai Yisrael, so to Itai. Elashiyam Itko Rebagat. V'rabim Yisrael Imo, he had many Israelites with him, as it says that we came to run with David, v'chol Gitim shesh me'ot ish, all of these 600 men were Israelites who came to run with David. You want to tell me that 600 Philistines came to run to escape with David? David? And all the children, they were certainly Israelites. They lived in God. The verse says that David called them Nochri ki Nochri ata, says the Radak. If you tell me it's because the Navi said Nochri ata, which all David meant to say was Nochrimi Eretz Acharet. They're from a different land because Eretz Plishtim was an independent, politically independent entity. If you say you garim begat, Moshe Malo. Therefore, he says they are all Israelites. So I want to make this clear. Up until this point, I've implied from our study of these names, and certainly the Radak chief amongst them, that all of these people, consistently, every one of them, is an Israelite, Jewish origin, living in a particular city wherever they're identified with. Whether it's Uyachiti, or Irayitri, or Tzelak Ha'amoni, or Do'ega Adomi, or Itagiti, the Israelites, Jews, Bechol Davar, living in these cities. So says the Radak. Not so clear, however. Contrast to the Radak, I have Rashi, who says, when it comes to Itai Hagiti, that he was a Nochri, he was a Gentile, and David says to him, "Anachnu borchim me'ein seida, we're leaving without food, mazon, we have no food, we have no provisions." Umitoch she'ata Nochri lo timsar merachamim, and because you are a Gentile, if you come with me, people aren't going to treat you the same way they're going to treat us. It's just the nature of the beast. It's the nature of we're going without our own food, and we're going to go be beggars and paupers in a foreign land. To bring another group of non-Jews with us is complicated. So Rashi implies here that they were Gentiles. The Al-Sheikh also quotes an opinion, Hinei Yir'amir Abotenu, Ki Goy Haya. Right? Would seem from our sages that Chazal certainly felt that he was not Jewish. And similarly, Gemara Navar Zara, the story of Itai Giti. That's Itai Giti. What about Do'ega Adomi? Again, go back. I'm going through all the list of all these names. Do'ega Adomi, Radak clearly said, Do'ega Adomi is an Israelite living in, we're coming from the land of Edom. I have a medrash that had a different opinion. Yalkut Shimoni says, this is a completely different story, the end of Shmuel Bet, the battle of Tziklag. But Yomar David al Nar HaMagidlo, David turns to the Na'ar, this young man who was with him, this Amalekite. Emi Ze'ata, where are you from? Ayome, with your running and trying to chase after Amalek, and he finds a castaway slave, and he says, Ish Ger Amaleki Anochi. I'm an Amalekite slave. נזכר דוד באותה שעה מה שאמר למשה רבינו אם יבוא אחד מכל אומות עולם ויתגייר שיקבלו אותו מזרעו של עמלק אל יקבלו אותו. At that moment David remembered the halacha that you're not allowed to accept converts from Amalek. That's a midrashic analysis. There actually is no reference to that in the psukim, that you're not allowed to accept gerim from Amalek, but that is a discussion here. ויאמר ואמר לו דמך על ראשך כי פיך ענה בך לקח נאמר מדודו. אמר רב יצחק, בנו של דואג האדומי היה. This ger, Amaleki, was the son of דואג האדומי. And that's why David said, דמך אבושך, your blood is on your own head. הרבה דמים שפכת בנו ביר הכהנים. You spilt a lot of blood in the city of Nov. ואית אמרי, דואג עצמו היה. And some say he really was, in fact, David had found, this was דואג האדומי. Who's described as a Ger Amaleki. In other words, the Medrash entertains the possibility that Edom here and Amalek are connected. And that Doeg Adomi may be a descendant of Edom or part of Edom. Meaning, not so simple to assume that because these were all Israelites, maybe there's a possibility that they are foreigners, Ger, converts, Ger Toshav is a foreigner, foreign resident who lives as a citizen of the country, unclear what the status is, but maybe that's also part of the reality. There is a lot of other nations and ethnic groups that lived in the borders and the boundaries of this expanded kingdom of Israel, loyal to David, and maybe these people, or Shaul, and maybe that's what the Ega Adomi is. He's an Amalekite or an Edomite serving in the service of the king, or similarly Itai Hagiti from Eretz Gat, which raises the question about Uriah HaChiti, which we're going to come back to momentarily. The question is asked point blank by Gemara in Kiddushin. Gemara says, Ein bodkin min ha-mizbeach ulamala. This is about yichsun. This is about if a person has a certain status, do you have to a certain role within the Jewish people? Does that give them the assumption that they are Jewish and that the yichus is pure simply by virtue of the fact that if it wasn't, they wouldn't be in the position they're in? Yeah, that's the Gemara's context of this Mishnah. If somebody is serving on the altar, somebody is a kohen and he's serving on the altar, by virtue of the fact that he's serving on the altar, we can assume that their lineage is unquestionable and that they are kosher. Their status gives them that right of that presumption, that chazaka, that they're kosher. V'chanina ben Antignos omer, af mi sheya muchtav be'istrat yesha melech. Similarly, one who is listed in the army of David HaMelech, a Jewish king, their lineage does not need to be investigated. We can assume they're Israelite. Somebody who's serving in the army of a Jewish king can make the assumption, says the Mishnah, that they are of Jewish lineage. Gemara on that Mishnah asks the question. Amar Rav Yehuda Shmuel b'chayelot shel Beit David. Rav Yehuda says the name of Shmuel, that we're talking about David's army, not just any army, but specifically David's army. Everybody who served in David's army was in lineage, was unquestioned, was of Israelite origin. Says the Gemara, v'ikat selek ha'amoni. What about Selek Ammoni? He's an Ammonite. Says the Gemara, no. It doesn't mean that he is Ammonite. It means the Yativ Ba'amon. He's an Israelite living in Ammon. Ika Uriachiti. What about Uriachiti? Does that not mean that Uriachiti is Uriah Achitite, foreign origin? No. My love, the Ati Michet? No. It means he lives in Chet. He's an Israelite. He comes, right, like I showed you in that list. It's a list of places where they live, like Tekoi from Tekoa and Bet Lachmi from Bet Lechem. What about Itagiti? That's the one that we saw earlier. If you tell me that he lives in Gath, I will tell you that Rav Nachman said that he was a Gentile because he dealt with that Avodah Zarah piece with the crown in the War of Ammon, and because of the reference that David HaMelech calls him a Nachriata, you are a Gentile. So not so simple. So suddenly this question of lineage stands front and center of these discussions in the Gemara. Now, the Gemara is going to assume that Itagiti is a Gentile. Does that mean that the Gemara retracted its position vis-a-vis Uyahiti and Selaka Ammonia as well? Unclear. Unclear. So where does that leave us? I've done a lot of talking. Where does that leave us? Leaves us with a question. Is it possible to entertain the idea that Uriah Hiti is actually not an Israelite living in Chet, but a Hittite serving in David's army? Again, it comes back to the question of how I read that list at the end of Shmuel Bet, which lists many Israelites from different cities in a pattern that matches Uriah from city of from area of Chet, etc. On the other hand, there are clearly referenced in David's world who were not pure Israelites. So what was their status? I would argue. Let me flip this around for a second. I'm not arguing. I'm not suggesting, and I'm not implying, that Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, granddaughter of Achitophel, advisor to David HaMelech, married a Gentile. I'm not suggesting that. I am suggesting that there were many such nations and soldiers in David's inner circle, as was Shaul, because they led an empire, because they had an army, because they had an expanded territory, whose origin may have been Edomite, Gittite, Plishtite, Givoni, etc., and who come to serve in David's army as an Israelite, not as a foreigner, but as an Israelite. Loyal to David, loyal to Israel, member of the Jewish tribe, member of the army of Israel. Let's call them what we would refer to either as a ger toshav, a resident ger, or maybe even a ger tzedek. Maybe they that's part of the process of gerus, is they come and they serve in the army and they live as Israelites in the totality, they become part of the Jewish people. It's not an uncommon phenomenon. Even in Israel today, the army is one of the most powerful tools for integration in conversion process. It's quite possible that that was going on in David's world as well, except for one problem. Source 26 is a Gemara in Yevamos. Tanu Rabbanan, Ein mekablin gerim liyamot ha-Mashiach. In the time of Yemot HaMashiach, we are not allowed to accept converts. Kayotsebo, says the Gemara, similarly, lo kiblu gerim lo bimei David velo bimei Shlomo. They did not accept gerim, not in the days of David and not in the days of Shlomo. Why not? Why does the Gemara assume that they were not allowed to accept gerim in the days of David and the days of Shlomo? You tell me.
Because they might have been spies?
I don't think they were spies. I think that was a concern. But you remember the motivation for conversion? What's the motivation for conversion? To convert, you have to be motivated by a desire to
become part of Israel.
Become part of Israel. What if you convert because Israel is the most powerful empire on the planet, and you're afraid that if you're not part of the Jewish people, you'll be swallowed up by all your enemies?
It's not a genuine
desire to become part of Israel.
Right. Is it realistic? Not today. But in the days of David HaMelech, when David ran the largest empire in the world, it might have been, or Shlomo. That's exactly the question. So let's look at the way the Rambam formulates this. Lefichach, he starts with the assumption that you can't accept gerim if there's an ulterior motive to their conversion. Lefichach, lo kiblu beit din gerim kol yemei David u'Shlomo. In all the days of David and Shlomo, they did not accept gerim. Why not? Bimei David, shema min hapachad chazur. In the days of David, they didn't accept gerim because they feared that they were the purpose of the reason they were converting was out of fear, meaning they were afraid of being part of the enemies of Israel. And in the days of Shlomo, because Shlomo's kingdom was the most wealthy, powerful kingdom in the world, Shlomo, whereas David had conquered the region and therefore instilled fear across the board, Shlomo, by virtue of his wisdom, had the wealthiest kingdom in the world. So these two empires, which were really the most extraordinary moments for Israel, they established a kind of a built-in question of motivation. Somebody comes and wants to be part of the Jewish people, the days of David, you have to ask yourself, are they coming because they want to embrace God and embrace Israel, or are they coming because they don't want to be on the other side of the battlefield with Israel? Follow? Somebody becomes a convert because they are from other reasons, other than their purity of their devotion to God, they are not considered ger tzedek. Now, here's the clincher. Nonetheless, hayu gerim harbe mitgerim bimei David u'Shlomo. There were those who converted in the days of David and Shlomo. This is going to ring very contemporarily. Right? Even though the halacha was that the Beit Din, the courts, would not accept Geirim in the days of David and Shlomo because the courts always suspected in the days of David, the Malchus and the strength of Israel, that their motivation was not pure. Nonetheless, there were many who sought conversion in the days of David and Shlomo. But they did so. They went to non-professionals. They went to laymen. They went to non-Beit Din. They went to other sources. They went to Cyprus. They went somewhere else. And they found some other not official channel to convert. And now I have all of these Israelites, quote unquote, status is questionable. Are they converts? Are they not converts? Are they accepted? Are they not accepted? The Beit Din HaGadol, great, the Sanhedrin, the Beit Din, they always had a question. And so they were wary of them, but also not completely dismissal of them. They didn't push them away. Right? They went to the mikveh, they went to Beit Din. And so they have a questionable status. And they didn't go embrace them either. They held them at arm's length until they could see and test their loyalty and their sincerity. So what the Rambam describes in the time of David HaMelech, when it came to conversion, when it came to all of these foreign entities, all of these non-Israelite regions that are now part Syria and Turkey and Jordan and Eretz Chittim and Aram and Ammon and Moab and Edom, all of these regions that were conquered by David and by Shlomo. Now I have all of these foreign people wanting and willing to serve in David's army, loyal to David. What's their status? So there are those who say they were Israelites. They weren't even Gerim. They were just Israelites. There's no non-Jews in David's world. On the other hand, the Rambam seems to describe a situation where there were many non-Israelites, converts, but whose conversion was questionable because of the nature of the time in which they lived. it's almost uncanny how contemporary this story reads. It's
like the Russians and Jews.
Right. Same issue. Integration into the army. What's their status? Right? Same issue. History. En chadash tachat hashemesh. So now what do you do with them? So they have all of these very high up officers serving in David's army, whose origins may be foreign, but whose loyalty is to the world of David. What's their status? The Beit Din doesn't accept their conversions. The Hedyotot do accept the conversions. What's their status? I'm going to throw out a conjecture. Pure conjecture. I have no proof to the theory that I'm going to suggest. I just think it's very compelling. If Uriah HaChiti is in this category, Uriah HaChiti, Doeg Adomi, Tayagiti, if he's in this category, then who's to say that when David saw Bathsheba, granddaughter of his advisor Achitophel, and he didn't go through his mind, he didn't go through the calculation. Well, wait a second. If Uriah Hiti is really a Hittite and he's not really an Israelite and his status is questionable, well, if his status is questionable, then his marriage isn't really Tophis. There's no real marriage, legal marriage status, then it's not really adult. Possible? I
very yucky.
Oh, I am not in any way, again, I want to make this very clear. This is not an attempt to justify David's behavior. It's to understand where he's coming from, because it's precisely over the, as you put it so precisely, the yuckiness of it, that the Navi comes to David and says, you are guilty of a moral offense worthy of the death penalty. Which the moral offense here is extraordinary. But the process that David goes through, immersed in that moment of the self-justification, is based on the fact that maybe, again, if I have a get, I have a get. That's one possibility. But maybe I don't need a get to create this question in his mind. Maybe it's sufficient to create a question in his mind because all of these people in his army are all of this kind of equal, of middle ground, questionable status. Hittite, Ammonite, Moabite, Edomite, accept Gerim, not accept Gerim. I don't know what to do with them. Okay. So up until now, they've been serving David loyally. And we'll see Uriah Hiti's loyalty to the army of Israel is unquestioned. But could David have gone through the calculation in his head? That's the drush, that's the vayidrosh, right? That's what he, when he sees her, he vayishlach David vayidrosh l'isha, he wants to investigate. Who is she? And turns out, vayom alazot batsheva bat eliam eshet Uriah Hiti, the wife of Uriah Hiti. Is it possible that David in that moment went through the calculation? Well, he's not really Jewish. And if he's not really Jewish, he can't legally marry somebody who's not Jewish. And suddenly, door becomes cracked open. And into that trap, David walks and falls into the abyss. But the justification that David goes through is by kind of working through all of these very shady pieces of the story. But again, what I'm looking for is an understanding of David. Not, we will get to the understanding of the Navi, who holds him accountable for it. But at the same time, that might explain what David was thinking in his mind. So I throw that out as a possibility. Take it or leave it. We now have three possibilities. Option number one, adultery, plain and simple. Deal with all the other textual issues as ever we can. Option number two, not adultery, moral offense, because every husband wrote a get to his wife. Option number three, David has many soldiers in his arsenal whose status is from foreign regions, Uriachiti, Doegadomi, Itagiti. And when this moment came, David raised the question in his mind as to the legal status of their conversion as a way of justifying the fact that maybe they're not really married at all. And that opens up a field that unfortunately he should never have stepped into.
It just,
possibilities?
It just seems to me, as a woman, mm-hmm. he goes, and I think there are other women probably who will agree with me here, that he just goes through all these twists and turns to get what he wants.
Oh, yeah. No, he's certainly guilty.
Yeah, and it's just... He needs to justify it, but he wants that, and he's going to do whatever it takes to get it.
Correct. There's no question that the power of self-justification here is very, very is sad. It's tragic, but that's exactly what he does. He self-justifies his actions. And then falls into one trap after another, because he's going to continue to self-justify Uriah and Uriah's rebellion and having Uriah killed, and then he's going to continue to self-justify. And from that abyss, somehow he's going to have to, if he can, we'll see if he can pull himself back. But that is exactly it. This is David out of character. I want to come back to what I said at the very beginning of the series, which is that we're spending a lot of time looking at a very short episode of David out of character. Right? David in Sefer Shmuel Aleph is a different personality. David in the first half of Shmuel Bet is a different personality. David in Sefer Tehillim is a different personality. What we're looking at with a microscope is a short episode of a moment of weakness, and we're going to spend a lot of time analyzing that moment of weakness. But was he correct? Was he justified? Of course not. And nobody is suggesting that he is, especially not the Navi. But my goal is to understand that process of self-justification. If it's just pure adultery, Yitzhak the Arias, as they refer to it as, right, falls into the trap of Arias classic adultery affair, maybe it's possible. I think there are other textual problems in that regard, but it's possible. It is a possibility. But this way, at least I have two working theories alternatively, again, that do not justify David, but explain the context of David's process of self-justification. Yeah.
If he thinks he's justified, then why does he go through, and he doesn't even think that she's married to Uriah legally, mm-hmm. then why does he go through that business of trying to get Uriah to go back to cover over for the fact that she's pregnant?
Because and now I have a child to have to worry about. And now I have a lineage issue. Now I have a mamzer issue and a perception issue, etc. So. You know, now it's we'll get to that part of the story next, but that's a whole different part of the equation.
But you are assuming, you're making, or you're putting out the line that Uriah was in fact Jewish.
Suggesting that his status as Jewish is questionable.
So it's still questionable.
Right. What I'm putting him into is in this category of the Hittites and Ishmaelites and Ammonites and Edomites and all of these foreign powers that are serving in the army of Israel. Are they converts? Are they not converts? Unclear. And especially we have rabbinic sources. We have a Gemara. We have the Rambam that say that explicitly that during that time, their conversion status of these individuals was unclear. And we know how problematic that can be.
Right? When you see all these names in Tanakh, do you stop with each name and decide whether they're Jewish, they're not Jewish, they're just from the country? I mean, is every single name looked at like that?
Well, it's very common to Sefer Shmuel. It's not so common elsewhere in Tanakh, but in Sefer Shmuel, you have a lot of them. And the Mefarshim seem to do just that. They ask the question, are they Israelites living in region X, or are they foreigners living, serving in the Israelite army? That is exactly the question. And so I've walked you through a complex maze of all the different cases in Shmuel. I think I've kind of touched on all of them. So it's not that many, but there are enough to raise the question.
I just have a question, because I still think it's wrong. And it seems to me, and they don't mention it specifically, but it's probably 6 weeks before she knows she's pregnant. So basically he took his pleasure and then that was it.
We don't know what happens beyond, in between that period of time.
Right. There's no mention of
it. Because Tanakh doesn't go through all the details. It just goes through, and that's part of the remember, Tanakh is written in as base as the story is, Tanakh is very careful to use a Lashon Nekiyah, very kind of almost euphemistic, but that's not only in David, that's across the board, right? That's right. Just the style of Tanakh. So Tanakh is careful there. Whether there was more than one night, whether there was beyond going, beyond that, it's unclear. All right, I'm going to pause here for a second. It's already 2 minutes past our time. Two things. I want to repeat the request that I made at the beginning of this year. If you are not on our email list, if you put your name on the email on the chat last week, to be added to the email list. That chat got deleted. I apologize. If you could please put your name and email address on the chat to make sure that I have you on the email list, that would be helpful, number one. Number two, Phyllis, to come back to your question. I have not even begun to address the question of Bathsheba and what role she or she doesn't play in this relationship. That is a very important question. We haven't addressed the dynamic of the relationship between Uriah and Bathsheba, which is also part of the story, and between Uriah and David. It's multiple pieces. So that's why I said I want to try to do this slowly. Maybe it's too slowly. But nonetheless, I think it'll be better for us overall if we tackle each one of these people in the story as a unit to themselves. So Bezrat Hashem, our goal for next week is to come back to this question of Bathsheba and Uriah and their relationship and what role that plays in the story. And at least as a part one, and we'll come back to that, continue on that role, on that line of Bathsheba and her role and what impact it has on Bathsheba, Bezrat Hashem, in weeks and months to come. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Have a good week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.